You're listening to episode number 50 of Does Not Compute. Today's episode is brought to you by Zendesk. No matter how many tests you write, sooner or later, users are going to run into issues using your product. It's super important that when that does happen, you make the process of getting answers as painless as possible for them. Sure, you can just have a contact us email link, but that's not really a great experience. That's where Zendesk can help. They've got awesome mobile SDKs that make it really quick and easy for you to add in-app support. That means your users can submit support tickets and view help documentation without having to leave your app. Better yet, the tickets can automatically include information about the user's app and device version, app usage history, and more. All these tools have a great default UI to help you get started quickly, but you can also build out something totally custom if that's more your style. All this is included with Zendesk for no additional charge. I use Zendesk all the time at work when helping with developer integrations, and it really is awesome for the user and the folks providing support. Check out Zendesk today and learn more by visiting zendesk.com/doesnotcompute.
What's the temperature like over there right now?
Let's see here. It is, come on, notification center. 70 degrees.
Sounds very pleasant.
It's not a California 70, that's for sure. It's a swamp 70.
Got that high dew point.
Yeah, yeah. I spent most of yesterday in Burlington with Kevin, again, who I mentioned last episode, I believe. And it was a humid one, for sure.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
Just hot, man. Just hot. But no, it was fine. It was just cool to get away for a little bit, get out of town, get away from a computer. You know, last week is super busy. I think maybe on Friday night I stayed up all night, and or was it Thursday night? I can't remember. One of those two nights I stayed up all night working on night.
I'm pretty sure it was Thursday night.
Yeah, yeah. So had to make, you know, a few last minute adjustments for them and kind of tighten things up. You know, add Google Analytics tracking and stuff like that. So. You know, I didn't even today, you know, today being Sunday, this is the first time being back at the computer, actually. So, feeling a lot better.
Nice. That's cool. It's always good to get a little bit of a break there.
I was so tired. It took me a couple of nights of sleeping to recover from that.
But Sean, it's live now.
Yeah.
Night Foundation is live, and you worked on that for like a year. That's got to feel pretty good.
It feels weird because I had a heavy dose of imposter syndrome. Looking at it, you know, I see things that I want to change or things that did change that I'm not necessarily a big fan of. You always look at stuff and think to yourself like, I could have done better, or, you know, you just want to do more, but you run out of time. So it's just out there. So yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it. It feels good, you know, because, you know, obviously I'm still working on it here and there. You know, we have a retainer going forward, so I'll be doing, you know, updates and bug fixes and stuff, but I won't be on it full time anymore. So it'll feel different, I guess, tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, getting to move on to have new primary projects after a year is going to be, I'd imagine, pretty nice, but also just very strange at first.
Right. And the cool thing is there's not any like downtime for me. The project I have coming up isn't like a massive thing. It's more of a kind of, you know, a few week dev project, but it is going to be different because I'm used to waking up, you know, and if my computer's restarted or something, you know, opening up my terminal and just like muscle memory, you know, CD into the directories and start up Rails and start up Node. And, you know, so it's going to be cloning a new repo and starting from scratch, but I'm looking forward to that, you know. I feel like I've learned a lot since I started Knight, and so it'll feel good to start on something fresh, that's for sure.
Yeah, that was always one of my favorite parts of doing consulting work, actually, is that you get to work on something and think about a specific problem space for a little while, and then you get to move on to something else, and you have a totally different routine, you're working with different people. It's just always kind of cool to have that bit of movement in your day-to-day workflow.
Yeah, definitely. And the cool thing is that this is the first major, I mean, like you could call it a website, but it's more of like an application, right? Because it came with a Rails app and Rails admin side and an API and a JS client. So this is like the first major web app that I've used something like Vue on, where, you know, I wasn't modifying DOM myself. I wasn't using jQuery or something to build out the UIs. I was using Vue, and everything was based off of data. You know, when data changes, when the client gets updated data from the API, the DOM just updates itself. And I can say that, using Vue sped up development quite a bit. And also it resolves or just removed a whole bunch of bugs that I don't even have to think about, which was great.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really struck me when I first started using Vue. And it still surprises me a lot of the time is how little DOM manipulation you have to do when you have something responding to data somewhere else. It just becomes somebody else's problem.
Yeah, I mean, it allowed me to think more about trying to keep the design implementation consistent. And this is also the first major project that I used functional CSS on. And this was the project that kind of spawned off that decent.scss that we mentioned a while ago. So I feel like, I mean, obviously there's things that need to be tweaked, especially with like the WYSIWYG content, because a lot of their content is implemented or added with Redactor on the admin side. So, you know, there's a whole section of CSS that is solely for, you know, styling WYSIWYG content. But apart from that, all of the rest of the design is implemented using functional CSS and, you know, class-based selectors and in Vue components. So there's a lot of component sharing, like all of the actual page templates themselves use like the same page header, the page hero component. Heroes that have featured items in them use the same component. So I feel like it was easier for me to maintain consistency across the design. But also there were a lot of, like, we got in, you know, 6 months into development and there had been a lot of scope changes. So they started using the site and realizing that, you know, there are some redesigning that needed to happen and some rethinking of some of, you know, how we were displaying some of their data. And it made it really easy to kind of flow with that, because I know that when I was changing the views, I wasn't breaking anything else accidentally. Which is a huge thing, is a huge thing. Oh, man, that removes so much stress in debugging. It's so crazy how almost easy it was to make design changes.
So it sounds like you were following completely functional CSS practices where a class, once it's written, becomes immutable. You can't go back and change it ever. So when those design changes happened, you would create new sets of classes?
So how it works is that there is a few files, like SAS files, that go ahead and generate classes for me. So like margin and padding and kind of your base box model kind of stuff. And a lot of the design changes weren't necessarily that I need to make one-off classes to deal with design stuff. It was more like I had to relay out the DOM and add, like, change the margin, change the padding. So for me, it wasn't so much a have to go back and adjust selectors. It was have to change selectors on the DOM or change the DOM itself to reflect maybe a new layout that a design would come through.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm actually getting really close to launching the first project I've done with functional CSS that's kind of larger. And I've noticed the same thing. It's like when I need to change something, there's no stress of, okay, wait, where else is this being used? Let me do a global search in the project. Let me see what's going to break if I change this. It's just like, oh, I know exactly what this does and I know what I can and can't change. There are rules in place for me already that are just defined by this way of working with CSS. And that's pretty nice.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I will say that you know, it goes from finding and placing in CSS to finding and replacing in HTML. But to me, that's vastly less complicated than the former, because then you're not worrying about cascade. So for example, if you have a certain component that maybe you couldn't roll into one, and there's a similar component that looks the same, but it's actually in two different files, like view files or something like that, you know, you'd have to change one and then you'd have to remember that there was a second one. But you could do a project-wide search and you could see that pretty easily.
But even if you did change one, the other one wouldn't be broken. It just wouldn't be updated to reflect the new styles. So there's just inherently less risk there anyhow.
Exactly. I say that because I've seen some people kind of say, well, you still have to find and replace and do all the searching and stuff. But there's less riding on it, I guess you could say, if you have to do that. But I mean, it made it really easy to see, like, yeah, I can do that and I can have it done in a couple hours, as opposed to I can do that and I have to test the entire site over again, which was pretty great. And the site csspurge.com, I believe it is, you know, it kind of talks about like CSS bloat and all that, how using, you know, like OCSS or, you know, just traditional way of writing CSS, how you can get lots of repetition. And I was talking to you earlier today and I was saying like how I wanted to get the bundle size down a little bit. And you know, I look at how many different views there are in the Knight website, how many different, it's just a big site. There's a lot of stuff on it. And then I looked at the CSS size, the final compiled size, and it was only, 23 kilobytes? I thought that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think it was like 28 kg zipped or something like that. Pretty solid for as large of a site as that is.
Yeah. And even then, I know there's stuff I can go in and take out. So I know that some of the generating SAS functions, they generate more classes than I actually need. And it might be the case that I could use I think there's a package called maybe Purify that removes CSS. So it looks at your templates and then it looks at the classes you use and then it looks at the classes in your CSS and it strips out any unused stuff.
Yeah, kind of like a tree shaking algorithm.
Yeah, exactly. And now it can be kind of a pain to set up because you actually have to look through your site to see if anything got jacked up. But, you know, I could implement something like that. You know, I could, there's certain views that are kind of, so the JavaScript way right now is what, like 250K. And for most normal sites, I'd be like, well, that's too much, just too much. But I have to remind myself that like, that includes all of the views, you know, all of the actual page templates are in the JavaScript because it's all JavaScript. And there's certain page templates that aren't being used anymore, or there's been changes to page templates where I can remove things inside of conditionals because that conditional will never get triggered anymore. And that's kind of where some of that imposter syndrome stuff was coming in, where I know that's in there and I know that it probably needs to be addressed. It's not mission critical, but I know it.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one of the realities of larger projects is that over time, there are things where you're like, yeah, I'm going to throw a to-do in here. And you do your little to-do comment, and then that will live in source control for the rest of time.
Forever.
And it's so hard because, I mean, there are more important things than optimization. As terrible as it is to say that, bugs are always going to take priority. New features are usually going to take priority because nobody wants to pay for you to go back in and like save a few kilobytes in the CSS and JavaScript. Nobody even knows what that means. No client even knows or cares about that.
Right.
So it's just, it's a tough balance for sure.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, throughout the whole project, my main focus was on speed because their old site was, to me, it felt pretty slow. To me, it felt kind of a drag to use just because the pages were so slow to load. And I haven't done any like hard testing for numbers or anything like that. But, you know, I did ask them after it launched because we had been using on staging and even the staging setup on cheap Heroku hardware was much faster than their production, than their old production site. And so, you know, Heroku, we got their bill. So they were using like a managed server setup and they were paying a good chunk of money per month for that. And through Heroku and AWS, you know, their bills are like exponentially lower than they were. And their site responds, I don't even know, three or four times faster, it feels like. Like I said, I don't have any hard numbers, but it feels way faster, even with throttling on.
Even if it's actually not that much faster in real world, it does feel a lot faster. There's certainly a perception difference in speed.
Yeah, and part of that's because it's a spa, and so on the first load, you know, you get the JavaScript and it gets cached. And then every time you click on a link, you only get data from the server. So that helps it make it feel very quickly. And that's another reason why I like spa so much, because if you think about mobile, the initial payload is there, like the payload hits there. Granted, I try to keep it as low as possible. And still, you know, 256 or 255K JavaScript, you're like, that's a lot, but it's not nearly as much because you go looking around, you'll find sites that are shipping much more CSS even than that, you know, a megabyte of CSS.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when you load their site on mobile, before I don't even think their old site was responsive, but now you load it on mobile and you get the first hit, you know, it may take a couple of seconds, but pages after that, again, the client, the phone isn't even downloading any more assets. It's just pure data.
Yeah, I mean, a meg of CSS and a meg of JavaScript is, I would say, pretty normal these days for many sites. And that's kind of crazy, actually, but that's the reality that we live in.
Yeah, the more we talk about it, the better I feel about things. But, you know, when it went live, I was just like, oh, crap. Because I know people are going to look at it, you know, their staff has to use it, you know what I mean? It's just, I don't know, it just feels like a chapter is closing, if that makes sense. And there's a lot of feelings that kind of go along with that.
I mean, so this was also like the first app where you had the client server architecture, you have an API server, and then you have a completely front end only app that's actually grabbing that content and doing something with it.
Mm-hmm.
How was that to work with? Did you like that?
I liked it a lot, actually, especially once Josiah came into the project. He was primarily focused on, you know, pure backend stuff, building out the rest of the API. And, you know, we kind of decided on a spec to use and going from there. So he was kind of focused on that. And then I was focused on implementing it. So I would file issues, trying to be as descriptive as I could. And I would, for each issue, I would have a spec with a list of items, like a checkbox list. Like, it should do this, it should do this, it shouldn't do this. And that freed me up to just implement the design and try to be as consistent as I could. But also another thing I noticed was that, you know, as design changes were coming in, that didn't affect the API at all. I didn't have to test that stuff because it wasn't even the same code base. So on other apps that I worked on it was more tied to like server, you know, server rendered pages, you would make design level changes, but then you might also be touching a lot of other stuff in that. And of course, then you have to go about testing the design stuff and the other things you touched. Whereas in a, you know, separated, like a headless CMS situation, you don't have to worry about it.
Well, I'm really glad that worked out, because that was like one of the last decisions I made before I left Octopus.
Yeah, you're like,
I made that like a couple days before my last day or something.
You're like, it's going to be a spa on your way out.
So long. Enjoy the spa.
I think it worked out really well. And another cool thing is, you know, I don't think that they'll ever do something like this, but if, you know, they have 10,000 grants and they're always adding more. If you're not familiar with Knight, or people, the listeners aren't familiar with Knight, they're a foundation, and what they do is they take money and they dole out grants to researchers, essentially. So they have something like 10,000-11,000 grants in the system. And, you know, if they wanted to release an iOS or Android or whatever, a separate website that was solely based off of searching and viewing grant data, they could do that. And they wouldn't need to spin up a whole new project for an admin, because it already exists. You would just use the existing API to grab that data. So in my mind, it enables them to do some really cool stuff with, you know, it's obviously going to save them money because they don't have to re-implement an API every time. And it allows them to make more software that their users might find useful.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big long-term advantages of having something that either is just an API or can easily have pure API endpoints added onto it. You just get so much more flexibility there. You can do anything you want with that data. You can just open it up to the world if you want and let other people make cool stuff.
Exactly. And I mean, for Octopus, it's good too, because we could say, like, we could kind of slide an idea across the table, like, hey, what do you guys think about making this app? Guess what? We can do it. And, you know, for us, it could be, you know, reoccurring work, new projects coming, whatever. Or, you know, they could, if they wanted to hire an iOS shop, they could do that. So I'm a big fan of that setup because of that reason. It gives them more flexibility to do things, because what they are is their data, right? So people go to them to look at their data, to apply for grants. So if they can come up with more creative ways to allow people to view that data and consume it, you know, that only benefits them and what they're doing. So I feel like we did a good job in providing them something they could use going forward and build on top of.
Right. And I mean, even on a smaller scale, Knight Foundation often makes those little microsites. They have things separate from their main site where they're showing information about a certain project or a certain type of grant that they've been doing lately. And now there's an API. So they have the option, if it's helpful for a specific one of those sites, that they can pull in that data live just directly from the one source of truth. And that's super cool.
Yeah. So that was actually a really interesting challenge as well to solve on the front end. So I mentioned before that the backend and admin is just a Rails app, and then it has an API portion, and it has a server rendered admin portion where they actually edit the content. And the front end is actually an Express.js app. So they have they have those microsites, which are one-off sites that were designed by other people, basically. And when you go to a certain URL / microsite URL, you kind of get like a fresh site that doesn't even look like Knight Foundation's current site at all. It's kind of like a mini site. And so one of the more fun challenges I had to solve for this project was figuring out how to implement that. So there's a couple of different ways you could look for, you know, that route in ViewRouter, and then you could basically wipe the DOM and write the DOM that you get from the server. I didn't like that, because then, you know, you have to pre-render all that stuff, because if someone shares it, it won't unfurl. You know, if Google hits that, it'll cache it, which is fine. But it's mainly just like sharing stuff, and you just kind of have to worry about anything that could go wrong if I'm wiping all of the DOM and writing an entire web page back. And what I opted to do was, since I'm using Express, is I have a route that happens before it matches. And if you're hitting a feature URL, it actually Express itself requests for that page from the API. And then it responds with the HTML the server or the API responds with. So that way I didn't have to clutter up. I didn't have to clutter up my view app. I didn't have to write any conditionals like, if this exists, then just wipe the page. You know, I felt a lot cleaner, but I felt like that was a pretty fun challenge to solve. And it's like another cool thing about how things are set up, where I can do stuff like that because the client is an Express server. So I can do some more server-side style processing before you actually even get to the spa in the first place.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. That allows you a bit more flexibility for sure. That's very cool.
Yeah, it ended up working pretty well. There's other things too, like I'm using some, so they have, you know, like 10,000 blog posts. They have a ton of blog posts. And so there's certain URLs that are kind of hard coded from a way, like a way old WordPress site they were using. And so they basically had different servers around that were holding folders full of images just to serve them. And so what I did was I wrote a rsync tool to grab all that and just push it to AWS. And then in the Express app, I just created some proxies. If a request goes to this, actually just go to AWS and return it instead, which ended up working really, really well.
It's always so tough. That's one of the biggest things with any project where you have legacy data is just making sure all the assets get shifted around correctly.
Yeah, Express made it super easy to handle that. It was almost too easy. I felt like, you know, is this actually going to work? Because it didn't seem like there was enough effort to put in there. But it works out really well. And yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. And again, you know, they can condense the number. So all the assets are on S3 now. So basically all their stuff is in one place. And obviously I have complete faith in Amazon that they're not going to botch anything. But before, you know, they had stuff spread out on different servers and everything now is consolidated and it feels a lot cleaner. So on another subject, I think I tweeted about this maybe a couple of days ago, but a friend of the show, Charles Peters, hit me up on Twitter and just asked me if I wanted a pair program something.
Yeah.
If I wanted to pair program something with him because he had heard that I was working with Happy and he was kind of curious. So I don't think we've mentioned it before, but there's a site called hyperdev.com, which is actually really cool. And it gives you a Node VPS and you basically just sign in through GitHub and then you have a backend setup and a front end setup and you can just start building a Node app. Super easy. And yeah, so I wanted to throw an invite out to anyone else. If anyone else is wanting to hack on some Node based stuff, let me know. I'd be happy to pair program with anyone and I'd be happy to learn from you and teach you some things if you don't know anything. So just kind of throwing that invite out there.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Does Not Compute. Once again, we wanted to say thanks to Zendesk for sponsoring the show. I'm sure most DNC listeners have heard of Zendesk, but what you might not know about are their great mobile SDKs. They make it super easy for you to integrate support ticket submission and help documentation directly into your app. That lets you do cool stuff like automatically include a device, app, and app usage history into tickets, and saves users the hassle of having to leave your app for questions and help. Make sure you check out Zendesk by visiting zendesk.com/doesnotcompute. I think we should definitely start calling it pairgramming.
Pairgramming.
I like that a lot.
And I'm getting hungry now.
Me too.
Pairs.
I was thinking more like grams. Like
s'mores.
Some Teddy Grahams, graham crackers.
Oh, Teddy Grahams.
Good stuff.
Cool.